She said a little prayer to keep them safe, to return Dr. O to Rusty and the girls to Corinne. Rusty took a cracker from her pocket, put it in her mouth, and chewed. "I think I'm starting to feel better," she said to Miri. "I'm glad." They stood together, mother and daughter, their hair blowing back in the wind. "I think I'll learn to ride a horse," Miri said. Rusty didn't miss a beat. "I think I'll learn to drive a car." "We can learn together, because you can get a license here at 15.
15? Who told you that?
"This girl I met at the Flamingo."
"You made a friend?"
"It's too soon to call her a friend." Rusty drew her close.
"We're going to be okay. This is all going to work out. I can feel it in my bones."
Miri wished she could feel it too. Until she could, she hoped Rusty was right.
35 years later, February 10th, 1987. The flight attendant gently nudges Miri. They're coming into Newark, and her seat back has to be returned to its upright position. She's still a nervous flyer, still digs her fingernails into the fabric of her seat cushion for landings. She could have waited until tonight and come with Christina and Jack on the company plane, but she wanted to do this on her own. It's not the first time she's flown into Newark Airport. The flight path no longer brings planes in or out over residential Elizabeth. Not since the airport reopened in November 1952. But that doesn't stop her from thinking about it every time. It doesn't stop her from rushing to the doctor before a flight, sure she has a sinus infection, hoping to be told it's not safe for her to fly. She closes her eyes, sings a little song inside her head, until they're safely on the ground. Then she's up and on her way with all the other passengers. Outside, she grabs a taxi to the old Elizabeth Carteret Hotel, the hotel where Joseph Fluitt stayed during the investigations, where Mr. Foster stayed while Betsy and Mrs. Foster were in the hospital, where Ben Sapphire stayed when he wasn't sleeping on Irene's couch, and where Dr. O went when Corinne kicked him out of the house. Miri had been inside the hotel just once for a bar mitzvah party back in seventh grade. She can still remember the dress she wore, one of Charlotte Whitten's, though she didn't know it at the time. Black velvet top, sweetheart neckline, white net skirt. She tries to imagine Eliza wearing a party dress and gets a picture in her mind of her 15-year-old daughter, named for the city she's returning to, galloping on her beloved horse, in one of Charlotte Whitten's dresses from Bonwitz. She laughs out loud. When is the last time she wore a cocktail dress? No, wait. She remembers. Frank Sinatra's opening at the Sands, where they celebrated Rusty's 65th birthday. He dedicated "Fly Me to the Moon" to Rusty, which made her night. Miri didn't want a big bash for her 50th. She made Andy promise no surprise party. She hated surprise parties. Christina threw a barbecue at the ranch anyway, but at least it wasn't a surprise. She and Andy danced the hustle, the bump, the funky chicken, to prove to their sons, Malcolm and Kenny, both college students, and to teenage Eliza, how young they were, how hip, never mind that their kids had moved on to new dance fads. Andy is a great dancer, much better than she is. He's still trying to get her to loosen up on the dance floor. He's a skier, a mountain biker, an easygoing, well-liked guy. He's made a name for himself in forensic dentistry. She fought him on that one. She had enough disasters in her life. But he won, promising not to bring the details of his work to the dinner table. Her hotel room is nothing to write home about, but it's clean and light, looking out over Jersey Avenue. Christina and Jack are staying in a suite at the Pierre in New York. They offered her an adjoining room, but she opted for Elizabeth, explaining she was having dinner with Henry and Leah, who would also be staying at the Elizabeth Carteret. And she's been thinking about a story based on the 30s gangland slaying that took place in a suite on the 8th floor of this hotel. She's never lost her fascination for the Jewish gangsters.
She sits on the edge of the bed and dials Eliza at school. It's mid-afternoon there, so she's surprised when Eliza answers in a sleepy voice, "Hello?" She didn't expect her to answer at all, thought she'd just leave a message on her machine, the way she had this morning. "Hi, honey. Are you all right?"
"Why wouldn't I be all right?"
"I expected you to be at class, or at the stables." She means to sound soft, maternal, but knows she sounds judgmental. The school in the mountains of Colorado was highly recommended by the counselor they'd consulted. It was supposed to do wonders for children like Eliza, bright but unmotivated, who would rather shovel manure than read.
"You're calling to check up on me?"
"No, I just wanted to tell you I'm at the hotel, in Elizabeth."
"I can't believe you actually went."
"Well, I did."
"It just seems really stupid to me. It's not like it's your high school reunion or anything."
"No." Mary resists a laugh. To Eliza, a high school reunion must seem like one of life's major events.
"Well, it's your dime and your time. Just don't expect me to tell you to enjoy yourself."
"No, of course not." Mary no longer expects anything from her daughter, except to be challenged, berated, and humiliated.
"So I'll see you when I see you," Eliza says.
A statement, not a question. "President's weekend," Mary reminds her. "Tahoe."
"Oh, yeah. I forgot."
Eliza yawns loudly.
"Will everyone be there?"
"I hope so."
Mary doesn't ask who Eliza means by everyone. Maybe the boys and their friends.
Silence. "Eliza, are you still there?"
"Where else would I be?"
"Okay, then,"
Mary says, trying her best to keep it upbeat, positive.
"Take care, and I'll see you soon. Bye, honey."
Eliza shouts,
"You know I don't like goodbyes."
She slams down the receiver. How is it that Mary, who longed for a daughter after two sons, has wound up with an angry, sullen child like Eliza? She's still trying to figure out where it went wrong, but can't put her finger on it. She unpacks, hanging up her suit for tomorrow, and sets her toiletries on the little shelf above the bathroom sink. She studies herself in the mirror. It's unsettling how different she looks away from home, away from the familiar reflection in her bathroom mirror. Last time she looked at herself in a mirror in Elizabeth, she was 15 and growing out her Elizabeth Taylor haircut. Now she's 50. Jesus, 50. And her hair is long, lightly permed, with golden highlights. An improvement, she thinks. She's in good shape, runs 5 miles a day, but instead of running from someone, Rusty, Mason, Natalie, the way she did that year, she runs to clear her head, to give herself a burst of energy that carries her through the day. Christina has been trying to prepare her for seeing Mason tomorrow by dishing out small bits of information. His wife, Rebecca, will be visiting her ailing parents in Sarasota. His daughter and twin sons are all at college. But Mary hasn't been willing to talk about it.
"Please," she said to Christina, "that was so long ago. We were just kids."
She knows Christina doesn't buy her nonchalance, but she lets it go. Mary can't admit she's nervous about seeing him. Come on, who wouldn't be nervous about seeing her first love? Who wouldn't want her old boyfriend to find her attractive? If you don't want that, you don't go to high school reunions. You don't go to the 35th commemoration of the worst year of your life. Besides, she's not 15 anymore. She's not that girl whose heart was broken on a sunny afternoon in May. She's a woman, married with 3 children and a career. She's responsible, dependable, mature. Right? She asks herself. Right, she answers. She stays up too late that night, watching A Place in the Sun on TV. She'd seen it with Rusty at the Regent Movie Theater that winter, the year it won 6 Academy Awards, They'd each gone through two handkerchiefs, bawling over the young Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift. Rusty planned to come with her to Elizabeth for tomorrow's commemorative event, but Dr. O's health is too fragile, even though Fern is a doctor and offered to stay at the house. They gather the next morning at the site of the third crash, in the field behind Janet Memorial. The old home is in disrepair, no longer used to house children in need, children without parents or family to care for them. She wonders where those children go now. It's a bright, sunny day, mild compared to the bitterly cold winter of 1952. Mary stands between Christina and Henry, oversized sunglasses covering half her face, a cashmere shawl thrown over her new suit. She and Christina had gone shopping for today's event. They'd each bought a designer suit with big shoulders, right out of Dynasty. They'd laughed their heads off in the dressing room. Christina is the best friend Mary always wanted, the real deal. When it comes to Dynasties, Christina and Jack have their own. Irish Jack, that's what they called him in the early days. He'd built his dynasty slowly, shrewdly, though he swears he didn't have a clue back then, just knew he wanted to work hard and be successful for Christina and their girls. An understatement, if ever there was one. Went from being an electrician to an electrical contractor to a general contractor to owning one of the biggest commercial construction companies in the West, with Irish Jack lettered on the side of his plane. The mayor, Thomas Dunn, who was a 6th Ward councilman that winter, speaks from a platform. "The 58-day period that ended here on February 11, 1952, at 12:20 a.m., was the most memorable of my life, outside of World War II. Our mayor at the time called it the Umbrella of Death. Others referred to our town as Plane Crash City. But we know better. We know our city survived the American Revolution. George Washington slept here, as we learned as schoolchildren. We have been and always will be a proud revolutionary city, a welcoming city to immigrants from all over the world, where your parents and grandparents and even great-grandparents settled. Today, I welcome all of you and ask that you bow your heads in remembrance of those we lost, both on the ground and from the air. 116 died in that 58-day period, senselessly, needlessly, randomly. It could have been any of us." Already, Mary feels herself choking up. Three clergymen take turns reading out the names of the dead, beginning with the first crash. Mary waits for the familiar names. Ruby Granick, 22. Estelle Sapphire, 59. Then the second crash. Kathy Stein, 18. Penny Foster, 7. She lets out a small, unexpected cry when Penny's name is read. Henry reaches for her hand. Christina passes her a packet of Kleenex. She wipes her eyes, glad she didn't use mascara, and blows her nose. When all the names have been read, a children's chorus sings a medley. April showers, pennies from heaven, keep on smiling. Someone with style has orchestrated this day of events. After, they form a circle and toss flowers into the center. Most of them have daffodils or tulips, but Mary special ordered a dozen sunflowers through a local florist. Penny loved sunflowers, was always drawing pictures of the sunflowers in the print hanging over her family's fireplace. Then they join hands and close their eyes for a silent prayer. The ceremony lasts just half an hour. Their personal remarks are to be saved for the luncheon to follow at the Elizabeth Carteret Hotel. The mayor makes an announcement that the lunch will be hosted by Natalie Renzo, who will be signing books following the program. Mary looks around the circle, but can't find Natalie. She thought Natalie might show up to honor Ruby. Instead, she spots Gabby Wenders, the stewardess, in her old uniform. She must be in good shape, Miri thinks, to fit into that uniform 35 years later. And next to Gabby, the boy who rescued her, the boy who saved her life. Miri half expects to see the boy he was then, the boy she loved. Instead, she sees a grown man. Still, her knees grow weak. For God's sake, she thinks, trying to remember what her yoga teacher has taught her about breathing in stressful situations. He makes the first move, walking briskly across the field to where she is standing. Miri, he says. Jesus. Miri. He wraps his arms around her. Now she can't breathe at all. When he lets go, she pushes her sunglasses up so she can get a good look at him. Did she hope he wouldn't be attractive? He grabs her hand. I'm so glad to see you.
I'm glad to see you, too.
The voice that comes out doesn't sound like hers. Can I give you a ride to the lunch? He asks. Christina and Jack have a car, so do Henry and Leah. But Miri says, sure, and walks with Mason around the block to his red Mazda RX-7. She almost laughs, because Andy drives the same car.
I'd know you anywhere, he says, even with the hair.
I'd know you too, even without it. He's not really without it, just has less on his head, more on his face. He laughs. And just like that, she's 15 again. Except she's not. They're seated at different tables at lunch. She's with Christina and Jack, Henry and Leah, four others. He's across the room with Gabby and her handsome husband, their grown children and young grandchildren, and two men who were boys at Janet then, boys who helped rescue the trapped passengers. None of her old crowd is here. Suzanne lives in Seattle, married to a neurosurgeon. Miri tries to see her every year. Robo is divorced and has a gift shop in Westfield. Aside from 2 years at Boston U, she's never left New Jersey. Eleanor is a professor of mathematics at Purdue, married to an economist. She hasn't won the Nobel Prize yet, and didn't laugh when, a few years ago, Miri mentioned the possibility. Some things aren't funny, Eleanor told her. Miri and Mason still looks at one another through lunch. Miri doesn't blush the way Rusty does, but she feels her cheeks flush. She drinks two glasses of wine, too fast. It goes straight to her head. You go to my head. She must have sung that line out loud, because the woman next to her, a daughter of the Secretary of War who was killed when the second plane crashed, says, What? Miri knows she sometimes sings a line from a song out loud, when she means to sing it only inside her head. I was just thinking of an old song, she says. Don't you love the old songs?
I do, Miri says. My daughter finds me hopeless that way.
Mine finds me hopeless in every way.
Yes, that too. They laugh.
My father was a wonderful person, she tells Miri. I've never stopped missing him.
My uncle, Henry Ammerman, wrote about your family, Miri says.
The young reporter? The woman asks, eyeing Henry, who is seated on Miri's other side. I remember him. I was at the apartment the day he came to talk to my mother.
Henry talked to everyone after the crashes. Everything I know about writing, I learned from him.
You're a writer?
Reporter, now columnist, for the Las Vegas Sun.
Las Vegas, she says, in a tone Miri has heard a million times, as if ordinary people can't possibly live there.
The program begins as dessert is served, plates of cookies and some kind of mousse that Miri pushes away. The mayor introduces Henry Ammerman. Oh, God, it's going to be in alphabetical order? She's going to be next? She doesn't want to go next, doesn't want to get up in front of these people at all, especially not in front of Mason.
He was a young reporter for the Daily Post then, the mayor says. Today, He's a prize-winning journalist for the Washington Post. Ladies and gentlemen, Henry Ammerman.
Enthusiastic applause. Henry speaks well, painting a picture of Elizabeth at that time. The fear, the chaos, the adolescent rumors involving spaceships, zombies, sabotage. Ultimately, of a community coming together. Miri is as proud of him today as she was then. She smiles at Leah. Miri has never been as close to Leah as she'd once hoped. She supposes it has to do with the distance between them, which has become more than geographical. Leah was maternal to her during her college years, when she chose American University with a major in journalism. But Miri was into trying her wings when she came to Washington, and Leah wanted to clip them. The last thing Miri needed was another mother. She offered to babysit her little cousins once a month, more if she found she had a free weekend. She'd had plenty of experience by then with her brothers, William and Stuart, born a year apart. She'd spent her high school years surrounded by babies and toddlers. By senior year, Leah was lobbying for her to stay in D.C. "There's not one good reason for you to go back to that ridiculous town." "There's my family," Miri said, "and a job offer from the Sun." "You can do better. Go to New York. Don't waste all that talent." When Miri said, "I'm just going home for the summer," Leah didn't buy it. "There's a boy, isn't there? The one you met over the holidays." Well, yes, there was someone she'd met over the holidays, a dental intern working for Dr. O. But so what? Half the girls in her graduating class were already engaged, showing off their diamond rings every chance they got. "What's his name?" Leah said. "Andy. He's from San Francisco. Went to Stanford." She hoped Leah would be impressed. "Andy." "Yes." "You're just 22, Miri." She knew how old she was. "Give yourself a chance." "I'm not getting married." "You will. Someday." "Just don't settle." "I won't settle." She didn't give a hoot about a diamond ring, and the idea of one had probably never entered Andy's mind. When they became engaged a year later, he gave her new skis and a black pearl to wear around her neck on a chain. She still wears it, is wearing it now. He was a young dentist then and insisted on checking her teeth like a horse dealer buying a mare. "Nice," he'd said, once he had her in the chair. "Healthy gums." Before she'd even closed her mouth, he'd asked, "Will you marry me?" "This is a proposal?" she'd said. He'd nodded, embarrassed, and brought out a bottle of champagne he'd hidden in the cabinet. He filled two pleated paper cups and passed one to her. "I must be the first person ever to be proposed to in a dental chair."
"Is that a yes?"
he said. She gulped down the champagne, held out her cup for more. "Yes." Her family was happy. Marrying Andy would mean she'd stay in Las Vegas. Henry was always supportive. If she was happy, he was happy for her. They didn't marry for another year. When they did, Ben Sapphire gave them a bungalow. The mayor calls Miri's name. She still goes by Ammerman. If she'd taken Andy's name, Zinn, she'd be at the end of the program. She thinks about walking out the door and not coming back. But Henry comes to her side, takes her arm, walks her up to the podium, the way he walked her down the aisle on her wedding day, sharing her with Dr. O, who was on her other side. Two of the best fathers any girl could have. She hadn't invited Mike Monsky to her wedding. They'd found out pretty quickly there wasn't going to be much between them. The first summer he'd picked her up in Las Vegas and driven her back to Los Altos, where she never even met Adela, who had such a severe migraine she'd moved into her parents' house for the duration of Miri's visit. And that visit was cut short when Mike's kids came down with chickenpox. The following year it was worse. Adela greeted her, then left with the boys to spend a week with her parents in Santa Barbara. By then, she'd had it. If Mike Monsky wanted to see her, he could come to Las Vegas or take her someplace neutral. But it never worked out. She wasn't disappointed. She had a lot of people in her life. He was just a complication. Frecky stopped by once with Dr. J.J. Strasser when Miri was a senior at Las Vegas High. They were on their way to a medical convention in L.A. She'd invited Miri to lunch at the Sands.
"I just wanted to make sure you're okay," Frecky said.
"I'm fine," Miri told her. "I got into American University, my first choice college."
"Well, good for you," Frecky said. "I hear you've seen your fu—"
She hesitated before saying the word, then changed it to Mike. "Yes, twice. But we're both so busy, there's not a lot of time to visit."
"I understand," Frecky said.
"I'm meeting him for lunch in L.A.
He's flying down for the day, without Adela or the boys."
She sighed deeply. Miri nodded.
"I hear he's changed his name to Monk."
"Yes." Was she just finding out?
"Well, I can't say I blame him. Monsky was always a mouthful."
Miri took a bite of grilled chicken and chewed it very slowly. When she'd announced her marriage to Andy, Frecky sent a crystal bowl from Tiffany's. Mike Monk sent a $100 check. At the podium, Miri takes the leather-covered journal from her purse, opens to the first page, and signals to Henry she's okay. She begins to read into the microphone, glancing over in Mason's direction just once. His head is bowed. After enough time, it fades, and you're grateful. Not that it's ever completely gone. It's still there, buried deep, a part of you. The stench is gone from your nostrils now, unless someone leaves the kettle on to boil and forgets about it. The nightmares have tapered out. There are more pressing things to dream about, to worry over, to keep you awake at night. Aging parents, adolescent children, work, money, the state of the world. Life goes on, as our parents promised that winter. Life goes on, if you're one of the lucky ones. But we're still part of a secret club, one we'd never willingly join, with members who have nothing in common except a time and a place. We'll always be connected by that winter. Anyone who tells you different is lying. The final speaker is Gabby Wenders. She introduces the boy heroes, especially her hero, Mason McKittrick. Then her husband, Dr. Larson, her children and grandchildren present a plaque to Mason. The oldest grandchild, maybe 5, says to Mason,
"Thank you for our Gabby."
There's not a dry eye in the house. After the presentation to Mason, it feels as if the program is over. People stand and begin to say goodbye to one another when the doors swing open and Natalie makes her entrance, swooping in like a high-fashion gypsy, the queen of New Age, as she's known, her Santa Fe jewelry jangling on her wrists and around her neck. A buzz goes through the crowd, and people take their seats again. After all, she's Natalie Renzo. She's famous. You can see her on TV, at readings and book signings, in fashion magazines. Most people don't know Renzo is Osner, spelled backward, the kind of code name children come up with in third grade. But it's worked well for Natalie. She steps up to the podium, waits for the whispering to die down, and begins. "It was the winter that changed our lives," she says. "The winter we learned who we were and what we were made of." And that's it. She doesn't say a word about Ruby, just that she'll be happy to sign books. Please write the name of the person you'd like her to sign for on a post-it. Even Lee Patterson, daughter of the Secretary of War, lines up to get her signature. "My daughter would never forgive me if I didn't bring her a signed book." Miri does not get in line. She hangs back.
Did you really sleep with Warren Beatty?
Someone asks Natalie.
Why not?
Natalie answers. Everyone who had the chance did. She laughs, and the crowd laughs with her. Christina doesn't like whatever's going on between Miri and Mason. You'd have to be an idiot to miss it. The two of them making goo-goo eyes at each other all through lunch. Jack tells her to let it be. They're adults. They're not going to do anything stupid, anything that would mess up their lives. Instead, she tries to convince Miri to fly home with her and Jack today. The plane is waiting at Teterboro. But Miri says she's staying another night.
Fine, Christina says. I'll stay and fly back commercial with you tomorrow.
Miri looks at her. No.
No? What do you mean, no?
I mean, that's crazy. Fly back with Jack, and I'll see you day after tomorrow. I still need to talk to Natalie, away from her adoring fans, and I want to stop by the cemetery on the way to the airport tomorrow.
Don't do anything I wouldn't do, she tells Miri.
Never, Miri tells her.
Is that a promise?
Miri hugs her. Don't worry. But that's a phrase that's always worried her, even coming from Miri, her dearest friend. Christina is retrieving her coat from the cloakroom when an attractive silver-haired man says,
Hello.
Hello, she answers.
I went to school with your sister.
He doesn't have to finish. It's the sewing machine man's son, Zach Galanos. He seems nice enough, still teaching, though not in Elizabeth. His wife is an elementary school principal. They have two children. This was the life her mother wanted for her. A decent Greek husband, a couple of kids, a house in Cranford or Westfield. She never dreamed her life would turn out so different. A life of such wealth, it embarrasses her. It's laughable how her family's attitude toward her changed as her fortunes grew. She's heard her nephews refer to her as their rich Aunt Christina from Vegas, and sure, she helped put them through college, helped Athena open a new store at the Short Hills Mall. She made sure her parents were comfortable at their retirement home, and when it was needed, she paid for round-the-clock care. She came for her mother's funeral 3 years ago, and her father's a year later. Even her parents accepted having an Irish son-in-law. They couldn't resist their four beautiful granddaughters. The oldest, Nia, named for her mother, born when Christina was just 19, the bundle of joy who kept Jack out of Korea. It wasn't until 5 years later that they were ready for more children, three more girls in a row. She convinced Mama and Baba to come to Las Vegas for Nia's 18th birthday, sent the plane for them with Irish Jack painted on the side. They were impressed. She took them to see their favorite entertainers, Dean Martin, Liberace, and the Greek chanteuse Nana Mouskouri. Made sure they had ringside tables, everyone making a fuss over Irish Jack's in-laws. And when her mother needed an emergency root canal, Dr. O was there to hold her hand as the young, gifted Dr. Kairos, a Greek dentist mama, performed the procedure. Dr. Kairos was married to a former chorus girl, and together they made tall, beautiful children with perfect teeth. Okay, she'll fly back with Jack today, but that won't stop her from worrying about Miri. Mason is hosting a small reception for Gabby and her family in his hotel suite at 5 p.m. He invites Miri. She's the first to arrive and is embarrassed. She's changed into pants and a sweater, western boots, the cashmere shawl draped over her shoulders. She feels more like herself. She's flossed, brushed her teeth, and gargled with mouthwash, ever the dentist's wife. She checks out the room, looks out the window, anything to avoid sitting down facing him. He can tell she's uncomfortable and says, "I'm sure the others will be here any minute." He smiles at her, looking into her eyes, but she quickly looks away.
"Do you
come to Elizabeth often? She asks.
Almost never. It's changed, and not for the better.
I heard Janet closed.
In 62, when the state eliminated orphanages. End of an era. It's been condemned since the 70s. Kids break in at night to party. Makes me sad.
He offers her a glass of wine. Just water, she says.
I read your piece on Longy,
he says, handing her the water glass. She laughs. I was a senior at college. Sold it to the Las Vegas Sun. A heady experience. They hired me based on that story.
I like your theory that he never would have hanged himself, that it was a gangland slaying disguised as suicide.
I still believe that.
Jack sent other stories, too. The one about the fire at the MGM Grand.
I don't really specialize in disaster, but when there's a disaster, like my Uncle Henry, I'm there.
That was the disaster that led Andy into forensic dentistry, but she doesn't tell that to Mason. Vegas must be a good place for stories,
Mason says. If you like weird stories, it's great.
Well, I'm proud of you.
Again, he looks into her eyes. Again, she looks away, gulps down the whole glass of water. She's saved by a knock on the door. Gabby and her family, and a few minutes later, the boys from Janet, and Phil Stein. Oh, my God, she says. You're Phil Stein, aren't you?
I am.
I loved your mother.
And she loved you. Never stopped talking about you, even after you moved away.
Is she... It's awkward, asking if a parent is still living. He shakes his head.
She died years ago. Complications of diabetes and a stroke.
I'm sorry. She was so kind to me.
She was a good person. I'm still trying to convince my sister of that.
Mother-daughter relationships can be difficult, Miri says.
Tell me about it. I gave Mom a dog for her 60th birthday. My sister almost killed me. The dog reminded Mom of Fred. Remember Fred?
We have a dog named Fred, Miri tells him, and another called Goldie.
Goldie. My mother would have loved knowing that.
They both laugh. Do you have a family? She asks.
Divorced, he says, like half our generation.
Sorry.
But I have two kids. You?
Still married, she tells him, then adds, happily.
One of the lucky ones.
She nods.
I was at your stepbrother's funeral. Steve Osner. He was your stepbrother, wasn't he?
Yes. The family was devastated.
A military hero. He was my best friend all through school. The way Corinne threw herself over his coffin. I'll never forget that moment.
No one had told Miri about this. Rusty had been asked not to attend the funeral. She'd understood. She was pregnant again anyway, and as sick as the last time. Daisy went with Dr. O to the funeral, as much to look after Dr. O as to mourn Steve.
If only I'd been able to convince him to go to Lehigh with me,
Phil said.
Neither of us could stand the idea of Syracuse after my cousin's death. You remember Kathy?
I do. And her green velvet New Year's Eve dress.
It was an awful time.
Yes.
But Steve went and enlisted the second he graduated.
He shakes his head.
Maybe to prove something to his parents. Who knows? He was enraged by the divorce. Shipped out to Korea after basic training.
He walked into enemy fire, didn't he? They didn't talk a lot about Steve's death, but Miri knows Dr. O blamed himself.
Tossed a grenade into a bunker on Porkchop Hill,
Phil said.
Blew himself up along with the enemy. And you know, the war was basically over by then. But they kept fighting over that stupid hill, as if it mattered, as if it would make a difference. Such a fucking waste. Excuse my language.
Dr. O's never gotten over it. I doubt you ever get over a child's death. He and Rusty named my second brother Stuart. It would have been too hard to have another son named Stephen. It's bittersweet, chatting with Phil. Then Gabby, who takes Miri aside, and asks if it's true about Longy.
Was he really a mobster?
I'm afraid so, Miri says. He sent me a basket of flowers after the crash. He was such a gentleman.
Yes,
Miri says, then adds with a straight face, and he was good to his mother. She doesn't mean to be the last to leave. Or does she?
Before she reaches the door, Mason says, sit a while, Miri. Talk to me.
He brings her a glass of wine. She sinks into the sofa, tucks her feet under her. She's more relaxed now.
Hungry?
Mason asks. She shakes her head, looks right at him for the first time.
Do you ever think about how young we were? My kids are older than we were.
Miri.
Hearing him say her name like that, in a soft, slightly hoarse voice, takes her back to the basement in Irene's house, to the night they played Trust. He rests his hand on her arm, and just that is enough to make her tingle.
I didn't know how to hear your side of the story, she says. I didn't believe there could be another side to the story.
My side of the story is easy, he says. I was an idiot.
I didn't know how to forgive you.
I never blamed you for not forgiving me. No girl in her right mind would have forgiven me.
I couldn't compete with her.
If it matters, I was never with her again. A few months later, she married a guy who owned a bar, had another kid, and died at 39 of ovarian cancer.
That's sad.
Yes.
As she sips her wine, she can feel the pull. But she's not going to do anything stupid. Never mind the devil on her shoulder whispering, life is short, and then you die. He leans in, kisses her gently, waits to see if she responds. She does, then changes her mind.
I can't do this.
I know, he says. Neither can I.
It's all about remembering. It's all about being 15 and in love for the first time. She can almost smell the winter air outside the Y, feel the oil burner's warmth in Irene's basement, see the kaleidoscope, the colors, the patterns, which reminds her. She jumps up, walks across the room, and pulls a tissue paper-wrapped package tied in red and white bakery string from her bag. She hands it to him. I thought your daughter might like to have this. He rips off the paper, holds the kaleidoscope up to his eye, then hands it back to her.
Remember what I said when I gave it to you.
She remembers. He pulls her to her feet, hits the switch on his tape player, and Nat King Cole sings, Unforgettable. That's what you are. He's thought of everything. They dance, holding each other, swaying, the way they did at the Y. Is this what she wants? Is this why she came here? She loves the idea of the kids they were, the sweetness between them. She sometimes thinks of Mason when she and Andy are making love, when she's not sure she can get there, something new, something perimenopausal. As soon as she puts herself back, oh my God, as soon as she's there, she calls out, yes, yes, yes. And Andy is happy he's satisfied her so well. Does Mason imagine her when he's with Rebecca? Does he imagine Polina?
Do you ever wonder about what might have been?
Mason asks. Who doesn't? She collects her shawl, her bag, the kaleidoscope. When they say goodnight at the hotel room door, he touches her face. She goes back to her room, kicks off her boots, falls back on the bed, and calls Andy. She needs to hear his voice.
Are you okay?
He asks. Yes, but I miss you.
Miss you too.
See you tomorrow, she tells him.
I'll meet you at the airport.
But I left my car there.
So what?
She tears up.
Ask me about the snow on the mountain,
he says. How was the snow?
Perfect.
She meets Mason for breakfast the next morning. Then he drives her to the cemetery to visit Irene and Ben. The cemetery is close to Newark Airport, not exactly a peaceful sight, but it's where they wanted to be, with their families and old friends. She places a stone on top of each headstone. Ben Sapphire, the step-grandfather she came to admire, and Irene Ammerman Sapphire. She misses Irene, her nana, who loved her unconditionally, who taught her, by example, to take another chance on love. Miri wipes the tears from her eyes, then blows her nose.
She gave me her recipe for brisket,
Mason says. No.
Yeah, she did. And I passed it on to Rebecca. Every Friday night we have Irene's brisket. It's not exactly the same, not quite as good as I remember, but it's good. I look forward to it.
Irene would love knowing that.
She knew.
You kept in touch with her?
Holiday cards, the occasional note.
She never told me.
She didn't want to upset the cart. One summer when she and Ben were vacationing down the shore, she invited me and Rebecca and our kids to lunch.
I can't believe she kept you a secret from me.
She wanted to see for herself that I was happy. She already knew you were.
She never stopped trying to rescue people, to fix what wasn't right.
Rebecca fell in love with her.
Who didn't? She stops, then asks, You and Rebecca?
Up and down. But I think we're going to make it.
I hope you do. He checks his watch.
I have to get you to the airport. If you're really going.
She gives him a you-must-be-kidding look. He shrugs and smiles. They walk back to his car.
I'm glad we got to spend time together.
I'm glad, too. She feels satisfied, happy. At the airport, he kisses her goodbye in the car.
If someday...
He begins. Yes. If. But for now...
I get it,
he says, kissing her one last time. She's made a plan to meet Natalie for coffee in the first-class lounge at the airport before their flights. How long has it been since Natalie visited them in Las Vegas? She gave a lecture at the library on channeling your past lives during one of her book tours, but that was years ago, and she flew in and out of town quickly, with no time for family. Fern, who'd come in from Shiprock with her girlfriend, Aura, also a doctor on the Navajo reservation, had been disappointed. Now the two of them run a family clinic outside of Las Vegas. Natalie spies her first.
Hey, Brenda Starr. How's it going?
Not so bad.
You look better today. Yesterday you looked like a corporate executive in that suit.
If Miri thought Natalie would be different now that she'd achieved fame, she was wrong.
How was it seeing Mason again?
She asks. Like seeing a long-lost friend, Miri tells her. Like seeing you.
I saw your goodbye kiss. I doubt if that's how you'd say goodbye to me.
Miri feels her face flush. It didn't mean anything.
If you say so.
Change the subject before this escalates, Miri tells herself. So, Warren Beatty?
You like that story?
It grabbed my attention.
He was great.
So, it's true?
Maybe yes, maybe no.
We're back to that.
Ask me another one, girl reporter.
How did you know Kathy Stein was on that plane? Natalie pauses for just a moment. Ruby told me. No, really. How did you know?
Sorry if you don't like my answer, but it's the truth. Next?
Miri reminds herself not to push it. Corinne? She and her hubby spend winters in Palm Beach, summers on Nantucket. They play golf. I don't know how they can stand it. But then, I never understood my mother.
I suppose you see a lot of Fern.
I do. It's nice for Dr. O.
You still call him that after all these years? I tried Arthur, but it never felt right.
They get their coffees, carry them to a quiet corner, where Miri says,
He's sick.
I heard.
We're hoping you'll come to see him.
I was waiting for his 80th birthday.
You probably shouldn't wait that long.
August? Are you saying August is too long to wait?
Miri nods.
Shit.
Yeah.
On the plane, Miri is seated next to a young girl.
I'm Lily, she says. I'm 9. My dad is a pilot.
Is he flying this plane? Miri asks, sure that if he is, he'll be extra careful with his daughter on board.
No, he flies to Europe, she says, kicking the seat in front of her. I just came back from Portugal. Have you been there?
She doesn't wait for Miri to tell her she hasn't been to Portugal.
You should go. They have a lot of tiles there. Do you like tiles?
Yes.
Everything is tiled, except your toothbrush.
Miri laughs.
You think I'm joking, but I'm not, Lily says. Are you going to Vegas to gamble?
No, Miri tells her. I live there.
Me too, with my mother. My dad lives all over the place. Do you think it's weird?
Does she mean weird that her parents live in different places?
Vegas, she says. Do you think it's a weird place to live?
I've lived there since I was 15. My children grew up there.
And they turned out okay? Because my dad thinks it's not a good place to grow up.
They're fine.
Well, she thinks, two of them are anyway, but she's not getting into that.
What were you doing in New Jersey? Lily asks.
Visiting old friends.
Was it fun?
Miri thinks before answering.
In a way it was, yes.
The flight attendant stands at the front of the cabin.
May I have your attention?
She demonstrates the proper way to fasten your seatbelt. Then she says,
In the unlikely event.
Lily leans close and says,
This is the part I don't like. Why do they have to say that?
It's just a safety rule, Miri tells her, trying to sound as if she means it.
Are you scared? Lily asks.
No. Why would I be scared?
You're digging your fingernails into your armrests.
Miri tries to laugh.
Just an old habit, she tells Lily.
But Lily can see right through her. She reaches for Miri's hand.
Will you hold my hand until we're up?
Sure, she says.
Lily reminds her of Fern on their first flight to Las Vegas. But she doesn't tell her that. Instead, she says,
I have a daughter. She's 15. Her name is Eliza.
Do I remind you of her?
A little.
Is she dead?
What? No. Why would you say that?
Because you seemed sad when you said her name.
I'm not sad. I just miss her.
She's at school. I'll see her next weekend. Miri closes her eyes. Who is Lily, really? What are the odds that the two of them would be seated together on this flight? In the unlikely event. She hears the flight attendant saying in her head, Life is a series of unlikely events, isn't it? Hers certainly is. One unlikely event after another, adding up to a rich, complicated whole. And who knows what's still to come? Lily looks out the window, then back at her.
My dad says unlikely events aren't all bad. There are good ones, too.
Like meeting you on the plane, Miri says, making Lily smile.
Daisy spends time with Dr. O every day, an hour here, an hour there. Sometimes they tell each other jokes. Sometimes they reminisce. Other times they're quiet. He sleeps. She reads. Rusty says it's such a help to be able to call on her, to count on her. She still goes to the office 3 days a week. She still looks good, maybe because she gave up smoking when she moved to Las Vegas, maybe thanks to her condition. Who knows? That was so long ago. She can't imagine life without Dr. O, her oldest, dearest friend, more than 50 years of working together, 50 years of friendship, of knowing everything about the other, except for one. She never knew, she never guessed about Dr. O and Rusty. How he managed to hide that from her, she doesn't know. Proves that everyone, even the person closest to you, can have secrets. Rusty's let her hair grow and doesn't color it. She wears it in a braid hanging down her back. There's something about her still lovely face, silver hair, and clear eyes that makes people turn and stare, the way they did when she was in her prime. She's a Western woman now, though she's never felt comfortable on a horse or driving long distances on her own. When Miri and Christina ask if they can plan an early 80th birthday celebration for Dr. O the last weekend in March, she gives her blessing. That's 5 weeks from now, she thinks. Who's to say what will happen in the next 5 weeks? He's made his wishes clear. No more treatment. Palliative care only. Don't try to extend his life. He's had a good run.
35 fantastic years with you, my love.
When he says that, she dissolves. She can't bear the idea of losing him.
You're strong,
he tells her.
Not anymore. I need you to be strong.
She nods. For him, she'll do anything. If he needs her to be strong, she'll be strong.
I never expected to make it to 80, he says, and I'm not talking about cancer. I expected God to strike me down for wanting you.
She smiles. Arthur, you're becoming religious in your old age?
I've always been religious deep down. I never wanted to hurt anyone, not even when I was drilling a tooth.
She kisses him. Is it any wonder I love you?
No funeral,
he reminds her, for the 10th time. None of them knows if Natalie will show up for his early birthday party, but at the last minute, she does. She brings 15-year-old Ruby with her, the youngest of her 3 children, each by a different father. She's never seen the point of marriage. They stay in a 2-bedroom suite at Caesar's Palace, arranged by Christina. A car and driver are at Natalie's disposal, delivering her and young Ruby to Miri's house for Dr. O's party. It's a sunny afternoon, warm enough to set up the buffet on the deck. Eliza hits it off with Ruby Renzo.
What exactly is our relationship?
Miri hears Ruby ask Eliza. Eliza answers,
Well, your grandfather is married to my grandmother. That must make us something-in-laws.
Yes, Ruby says. Something-in-laws. Before sunset, Eliza and Ruby come to her.
Mom,
Eliza says with more enthusiasm than Miri has heard in ages, Ruby's invited me to Santa Fe for the summer.
Actually, Ruby says, we live on a spread in Tsuki outside of Santa Fe. Can I go?
Eliza begs. Please? Miri has to think fast.
Let me talk to Natalie about this and see what we can work out. Does that mean yes?
Ruby asks Eliza. Eliza says,
it means we'll see. Great, Ruby says. At least it doesn't mean no.
Miri laughs. So do Malcolm and Kenny.
She's going to be okay, Mom,
Kenny says of Eliza. I hope so, Miri says.
At least we didn't give you any trouble,
Malcolm says.
Right, Kenny? We were perfect children.
Ha! Miri remembers the pot plants in the closet, the acid trip to the mountains, the fake IDs falling out of Kenny's wallet when they were stopped by the police on their way to hear the Grateful Dead. But they've made it through. They're good young men. When the trio begins to play It Had to Be You, Dr. O gets up with help from his and Rusty's sons, and he and Rusty slow dance. Their grandchildren circle around them. They end with a kiss, and immediately the trio plays A Kiss to Build a Dream On.
The other guests get up to dance, led by Miri and Andy. She's felt